to tell you about Naptime Radio. It's a show for moms and dads, and these chicks are super cool.
Mac Daddy and Damia.
And they want you to listen.
Yes, we want it. We want it so bad.
I know you do. Heather and Kate offer helpful info for parents with their power naps. Oh, and did I mention? These chicks are sexy as hell, y'all.
Let's ride that train.
All I need is a ticket.
Let's eliminate one article of clothing for one meal. How about that?
Oh, now it's a party. So go to naptimeradio.com or click on the logo available on our site.
Nailed it!
Chase the sun.
Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast, episode 39. I'm very stoked. Yet again, we are back again with our good friend Dr. J for our second episode in what will be a regular occurrence. And we were just talking about it right before we turned on the microphones, but I'm really stoked about the questions. We got a lot of questions from listeners via Facebook. I was checking via Twitter. No, I did not get any via Twitter. And via the email, questions@thedadpodcast.com. And you said, oh, here's what I thought was interesting is that I thought these questions were really interesting. And you said these are run-of-the-mill questions that you come across all the time, Dr. J?
Yeah, pretty much. These are the things that parents ask at the office all the time. And most of the time, it's a pretty easy answer for some of this stuff. And it's sad to see that, you know, people are still with, gosh, old babies not getting a full night of sleep. Jesus. Yeah. It's sad.
Do you want to start there? Let's start there. Let's dig right into it. Let me see if I have so this comes, and here's what I'm going to start doing is I figured in case somebody doesn't like the idea of their name being mentioned or whatever in the question, I'm just going to read the question. But a mom writes in and says, "When will my child?" Or no, that's not the right one. That's a different one.
My son has never been a good sleeper.
Yes, that's the one we were. Never been a good sleeper. He is now 7 months and only sleeps from 6:30 p.m. to 5 a.m. Now, for me, my son goes to bed at 7:30, and this is my 20-month-old, though. But I've heard these people. My father was of the thought that if you make them, he goes, these people, they put their kid to bed at like 6 o'clock, and they wonder why it wakes up at 5 a.m. And he goes, if you let him go to bed later, but I've tried that. That didn't work. And when I first read this, I was like, that's almost 12 hours. But she says here, but wakes up. And actually, I think this is from a dad. Yeah, this is from a dad.
Yep.
He says 7 months, but wakes occasionally throughout the night for periods up to an hour. We also make wake him at 10 p.m. for a dream feeding and changing. During the day, he takes 3 naps, but the naps are only 40 minutes long. He is a
only.
He is a breastfeeder throughout the day, but the night feeding is a formula feeding. We have a strict routine with him for his bedtime, quiet time, bath, reading, and white noise machine, and naps. His routine is quiet time and then reading, but still he doesn't sleep for long periods. Is there anything we could do to make him sleep/nap for longer stretches besides giving him whiskey? LOL. He also cries when we put him to bed at night, and we have tried everything to soothe him, but he ends up crying himself to sleep. We have now resorted to letting him cry and soothing him every couple minutes. The sleep issue for him has always been problematic. He has never slept in a nap for more than 2 hours. He has never just fallen to sleep automatically when he is tired. We realize that parents are always wishing their child sleeps longer, but our son truly has difficulty sleeping or napping. We even hired a sleep doula, and she was useless. Biggest waste of time and money for us. Any words of advice would be appreciated.
Well, there's a great book called Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems. It's written by Richard Ferber, who's up at Boston Children's Hospital. His last name has actually become a verb for getting your baby to sleep through the night. It's called Ferberizing your baby. Mm-hmm. So any mom or dad that has problems with their kids sleeping should pick up Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems by Richard Ferber, MD. And you know what? First of all, you got a kid who's sleeping from 6:30 at night till 5 in the morning. And depending on the time of year, that is sunrise. You can't expect them to go past sunrise, okay? Yeah. You have an older kid who knows what numbers look like. You can give them a digital clock and say, don't you dare wake up your mom or dad before the first number on the clock is a fucking 7, okay? But at this age, the sun comes up, they wake up. They're making a couple of mistakes, though. The biggest mistake they're making is they're feeding the baby. Once the baby goes to bed at night, after 6 months of age, the kitchen should be closed, and it shouldn't open until sunrise the next morning. So by feeding the baby when the baby wakes up, or even, you know, doing that little dream feeding at 10 o'clock, it's unnecessary, and it's just teaching the baby, you know, or not teaching the baby to get through the night with a little bit of an empty stomach. So first thing they got to do is just stop feeding the baby overnight. And if the baby wakes up, a little bottle of water or something, but get ready to duck, because they'll throw that bottle of water at you full speed, because that's not what they want. So, you know, having them give a bottle of water, but they also say they're going into them every couple of minutes. I mean, you got to let him air it out. And, you know, they are at the point now where they let him cry himself to sleep, and that's what they've got to do. But they got to make sure they're taking care of teething too, because a 7-month-old is getting teeth coming through. So giving Tylenol or Advil or something before they go to bed and let the baby cry. Just, you know, take care of the possibility that the teeth are bothering them. And then you can let them cry for an hour and not feel guilty about it. And the next night they'll cry for a half an hour. The next night they'll cry for 15 minutes. And on the fourth night, they're going to sleep through the night and go to bed without any fussing. Every parent thinks that every night is going to be like the first night of trying to get their kid to sleep, but all you're giving them is the opportunity to figure it out themselves, and they will. Yeah. In a 10-hour sleep cycle, babies wake up 4 times. So if a baby's only waking up once in a 10-hour sleep cycle, they're rolling over and falling back to sleep
three times
without their help. Ooh. So you're 75% of the way there. Just let them figure it out and nudge it a little bit. But take care of the teething pain. Try not to feed the baby, because if you reward the baby with calories, you're rewarding him for doing something you don't want him to do, which is wake you up in the middle of the night. So they wake you up, you give them a prize. They wake up the next night for that prize. It's that simple. So stop giving them a reward for doing something you don't want them to do.
You know, and I can speak on this subject in my own personal experience. And this is, I can't thank you enough for doing the show, Dr. J, because I really do think it's going to help a lot of people, including myself, is that I went through a phase where I was staying with my mom in Denver, and she was supposed to help me watch the kids while I was doing shows. And my 20-month-old would not sleep all night, and he was kind of doing this thing. But at home, we didn't really have any problems. And I just said, you know what? I've tried holding him. I've tried rocking him. I got to let him cry it out. And my mom couldn't hang with it. And it is. You get in that mindset where you think, oh my gosh, I think, and it's probably because of my own history, is that I think I'm causing psychological damage to my child, that I'm making my child think that I am not going to be there for them, and that that's going to freak them out. But it's one of those classic things that I learned from my dad, is that very few times when you make things easier for people, you are really helping them. Do you think that kind of rings true even in this situation?
I agree. And you know what? I mean, I'm an East Coast guy. What the fuck is a sleep doula? Any guesses? Because
I think it's like a baby slip.
I let that slide, but was it someone who comes to your house and sleeps with your baby? What is a sleep doula?
That was one of my kind of chambered questions to talk to you about, this whole concept of a doula, because it's essentially, my understanding of it is that it's a midwife, but what it makes it sound like is a witch doctor. Like, how do these people go, you know what, I don't want to be called a midwife. I would like there to be more of a black magic tone to my title when I come to help you either give birth or now also take care of a child. And it just has to piss off guys like you like crazy. If I was in your shoes and I spent a good chunk of my life not only paying money out of pocket and racking up what I'm imagining student loans at the yin yang so that you could have a job where you can just take this a mass amount of information to then take care of small people as they're growing up, and then to have some fuckwad who just probably got a GED and took an online course call themselves just as much an expert as you.
That's right.
And for the trend to be, you know what knows who knows better than a hospital? A doula. What is That's way right. better than having a child in the safety of a hospital that it's been happening for hundreds of years is to go back when the infant mortality rate was ungodly. And do it in a fucking hot tub or in some field or a bed and breakfast or something like that.
Or the back of a Volvo, you know. I've had that happen. That was messy.
Oh, you've delivered a kid in the back of a Volvo?
When I was a resident at Hartford Hospital, myself and one of my Icelandic compadres, another resident, made a mess of the backseat of a Volvo.
Because there was no time to get her into the hospital?
Or I think.
There was no time to get her into the hospital? Is that why that happened?
Parking lot at the ER.
And at the time you're a resident, so is this like, because I imagine it's like the rookie cop equivalent of sliding across the hood and no time for backup. It's like, we got to deliver this kid now, it's coming.
We didn't have to do a goddamn thing. The kid just
just shot out.
Was there. It was just there. It was time.
And what was the dad doing? Was he happy, or was he like, oh man, the interior is never going to be the same?
You know, we didn't talk about, well, the resident and I talked about it afterwards, but yeah. I didn't discuss it with the parents. So yeah, I'm sure they had to have one of those crime scene people come in to clean up the back of the car. It wasn't leather either. It was that fabric seat.
Yeah.
I don't think you're ever getting the afterbirth out of that.
Yeah. It's always going to smell like a fish market and sex in there for the rest of the life of that car. You might as well just CarMax that thing and move on at that point. And
I don't know if they put that on the CarMax tag.
Yeah, the Carfax. Like, I don't think that's included.
Right. Backseat clean due to child delivery.
I don't think that's a required disclosure under the Lemon Law in any way, shape, or form. But
obstetrical procedures performed in car.
To get back to the question, though, here's what I'm curious about is that at my sons always took longer. I want to say even at 7 months, they were taking like an hour to an hour and a half nap like twice a day. Is there right. is there any validity to what my dad's theory is that just because you put a kid to bed early doesn't mean like that you should be putting them to bed later and then they will sleep in a little longer? Or is it just that's the cycle because of the cycle of the day?
Right. And the most important thing, and I think they said that in their email, is to have a routine at bedtime. Always have bedtime be around the same time. Always have the same routine. And once you're done with the routine, you put him down. And if he cries, you let him fuss himself to sleep a little bit. And, having it around the same time every night is going to be better. The three half hour, 40 minute naps kind of adds up to the right amount of napping. Most kids are going to take a, 30 minute nap in the morning and maybe, an hour or longer in the afternoon. But most babies are going to sleep, 10 to 15 hours a day. If you're lucky, you have one of the kids that sleeps 15 hours a day. And this kid's, sleeping more than 10 hours a day. So it's certainly, not on the short end. It's just not convenient for them. The feeding is what they got to stop. A 7 month kid, if they're over 16 pounds, they don't need to eat at night.
Okay. And
the whiskey works too.
Yeah. So. My other question is, the white noise machine and all that stuff. I have a sitter that would turn on a fan because we had a fan in there just to kind of cool off the room, and she thought we ran it to have white noise. Personally, in my ignorant layperson's opinion, that the more kind of crutches, if you would, that you create, then the more that's a harder scenario to create when they're not around. It's another one of those things where helping isn't helping. Am I crazy
right.
on that?
I agree. But you know what? You do what works. My okay. daughter, we put her in the swing, turn the vacuum cleaner on next to her, and it was like turning her off. It was beautiful. So I don't know why, but it worked. And people will do some crazy ass shit to get their kids to sleep. So.
Amen to that, my brother. Amen. So so don't go the route of the doula. And I'm going to stop you right now if you're already typing up your email about how much a doula saved your life. That's great for you. I would agree with Dr. J that
this is a specific doula. This is a sleep doula. Yeah. I've not heard of it. I mean, now they're subspecializing. Yep. Is that?
Well,
is that,
I know early on when I started the show, my old co-host, Bill Glass, talked about a shit whisperer that you could hire to come in and potty train your kid. And I wanted to do it just for the sake of being it, because he was having a rough go with his second kid potty training him. And I wanted to do it just to have him watch me bang out potty training in a weekend, because that's what these people claim to do is you bring him in for a weekend for – I don't know, $1,000, and then boom, they're potty trained. But it's, I think it's just like anything. It's no different for like you go through the pet store, for those of you that have like dogs or cats, and you walk through and some of those toys you look at, you're like, that is clearly somebody sat down and said, what is a, because that's their job. What is a person going to think is fun to play with for their dog? It's not what really is good for a dog. It's what, it's like this personification of the dog. And what was like, that's why they're shaped like baseball mitts and all that bullshit.
And the biscuits are shaped like bones for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. but like cartoon bones, not even like actual femurs or anything.
Right, so, exactly. Yeah. If you got a box of fibulas and tibias, and that'd be neat for a dog.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go to our next question. This is one that I thought was really interesting and kind of, I don't know, current, relevant, I think, in that. It says, my six-year-old is on Adderall for ADHD, and we have heard that he is too young to be medicated, and there are other ways. We did fight against medicating him, but when push came to shove, we finally gave in, and we have seen a very positive reaction in my son. What does Dr. J say about medication for kids with ADD or ADHD, and does he think six is too young?
It's a good question.
Isn't that solid? Like,
well, a couple of things. One is, like with any disease, you got to make sure of the diagnosis. And I find that there, you know, are a lot of six-year-old boys with ADD, you got to have six of nine symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that almost every six-year-old boy is going to have five of the nine symptoms. Okay. Every single one of them are going to have five of them, but there's very few kids who have six or nine out of nine. Uh-huh. And you got to be sure if you have a kid who has it, and obviously this child does because they've seen the positive response. If you don't have ADD, you're not going to see the response to the stimulant medications that you see. And sometimes for parents, you know, who are a little resistant to medication, just seeing the proof in the pudding of what kind of a difference it makes when that is the diagnosis is sometimes an eye opener. And you can have kids who, you know, maybe can read words but can't pay attention for 10 words. So the sentence doesn't make any sense to them at all. Mm-hmm. So they're reading the words, but they're not comprehending anything. And kids who have ADD can increase, you know, a grade, two grade levels in 6 months of reading just because now they can concentrate a little longer than just to say the word, you know?
But there's an asterisk next to their report card, correct?
Right. Now, in terms of the age, I mean, when you start a kid on any of the ADD stimulant medications, and we've got a lot of young kids now with anxiety, and, you know, they get started on anti-anxiety medications, the problem is you don't really have an endpoint as to when you're going to stop the medication. I mean, most people don't outgrow their ADD. Most kids don't outgrow their anxiety disorder. So, you know, for kids who are anxious at six, we do our best to control their symptoms until they get old enough to be able to benefit from, you know, therapy and talk therapy and stuff. And kids as young as six, yeah, I have them on ADD medications at my practice. But, you know, you obviously try all the other things in the classroom first, and you want to make sure the kid doesn't have a learning disability, and that's why he's not paying attention. And you want to make sure there isn't anything going on socially at home. You want to make sure there's no anxiety, depression, those kind of things all kind of have to get teased away. And if you're left with a kid who just can't focus without any of that other baggage, then they do respond real well to medication. The problem is how long you keep them on it. You know, He's only in what, 6 years old? He's in first grade. You know, middle school's a long way away. High school's a long way. He's going to go off to college. You know, how long do you start a kid on it? So that's my main hesitation in terms of starting a kid as early as six. But, you know, in certain kids, those kids who got the nine out of nine symptoms, they need a little something, you know? So, you know, I would say in good hands, it's not dangerous to have a six-year-old on the medication. They need to get monitored for, you know, appetite loss is like the biggest thing with the medications, and they just have to get checked. I mean, I see my kids every 3 to 4 months at the office for height, weight, blood pressure, that kind of stuff, make sure they don't need dosage adjustments, things like that. But as long as they're being followed, it's certainly not dangerous to have a six-year-old on it, but it's certainly, you know, the last resort at six. You know, third grade seems to separate the men from the boys. If, you know, a kid makes the jump from second grade to third grade without any problem, they're usually going to be okay. But if they need a little bit of a life preserver in first grade, you know, that makes me concerned they're going to be on it for a while. Either that or they're going to have to drink a lot of Mountain Dew.
Well, and for my own edification, if you don't mind, I'd like to back up a little bit and say, because from my standpoint, I was raised by redneck wolves. So I look at it with the ignorant opinion of like ADD seems to be a common prognosis that's just thrown around. Like that's what everybody's saying. And it seems like it's in a neck and neck fight with borderline autism right. or autistic traits and stuff. Is ADD, is it psychological or is it purely like a syndrome, like biological, or is it a combination
of
both?
It is a medical thing. I mean, the kids, the reason the stimulant medications work for kids is because stimulant wakes up the area of the brain that helps kids to kind of self-monitor themselves and focus and concentrate. And they have a chemical deficiency because that's what causes them not to be able to focus and attend. And when you correct that chemical deficiency by increasing that in the area of the brain that helps, they're able to sit there quietly and learn. So, you know, you're basically righting a wrong. It's, you know, unfair that these kids have a different biology than the other kids that are able to sit and pay attention in class. And you're really not doing anything to make them smarter or brighter. You're just waking up their brain a little bit so that they can, you know, self-control themselves a little bit better. And the opposite is true. If you gave a kid who's hyperactive something like Benadryl, which makes him sleepy, he becomes more hyperactive because that area of the brain is more subdued. So,
oh, really?
You know, that's and that's why it sometimes doesn't make sense that stimulant medications work for a kid who's hyperactive. It doesn't make sense, right? So, you know, but it works because it works on that area of the brain. And I tell my patients, the little kids, I say, your head's just this big bag of chemicals sitting on your shoulder. And sometimes things are out of whack and we take vitamins to help different processes in our body. And this is just another medication that helps to, you know, correct a deficiency that's going on in your head. And when a kid does well, like they said, they had a very positive reaction. Well, then, you know, why would it work? Why would a medicine work if there wasn't something to fix?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when you give a stimulant medication to a kid who doesn't have ADD, well, you know, they get buzzed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how does it, like, because I have an issue with my son. He's only 4, and I attribute it to him just being a 4-year-old, but how do I, like, I have to tell him a lot to focus, and I'm just not of the mindset to where I'm like, and I'm not saying that this is the right mindset. I'm just saying it is mine, but I'm not in the mindset where I go, oh, he must have – that will never enter my mind that my kid has ADD except for, like, I might think about it in the context of a conversation like this. I'll just think he's a 4-year-old, and I got to say, hey, get your head out your ass. Let's go. We got shit to do, you know, kind of thing. And how do I – is there anything I could look for that would be more of a sign of – or do you have to wait until he gets into a classroom setting?
Well, like I said, most – little boys are going to be little boys, and they're not going to, you know, concentrating, focusing, listening to you, doing what you told them to do 10 times is just not in their abilities at that point. So, you know, like I said, I think there are a lot of kids who have quirkiness and kids who have a lot of energy. And, you know, those are the neat kids. They're still being kids. But when they have to settle down and learn, and a class teacher has 25 kids in the class and 3 kids that are bouncing off the wall, you know, she can't focus on those 3 and ignore the other 22. So kindergarten to second grade is a tough. I mean, I would always try to see how they do kindergarten through second before jumping on anything. And like I said, a lot of kids make the jump from second to third, and you know they're going to be all right. And girls aren't the hyperactive ones. They just sit there with their hands folded at the desk looking like they're paying attention, but there's nothing going on there.
Oh,
so
really?
They're a little harder to identify because they're not the ones bouncing off the wall. I mean, most of the time, girls don't have the hyperactive part. They just have the inattentive part, but they look like they're paying attention, so we tend to ignore it.
That's interesting. Also, that makes brings up another question in my head is that I've read online that when your child was born near the cutoff date for making it into school, that sometimes it's better to wait or at least have them do like a developmental test. Like, so in the example of my son, Jacob, he was born on September 2nd. So he will turn 5 and be newly 5 when he's supposed to start kindergarten. And what they've said is that statistics have shown that those kids who are near the cutoff date tend to struggle more in school just because they're not developmentally ready to sit.
Bullshit.
Is that bullshit?
I think so. I mean,
really?
Honestly, when kids are all going at different clocks, there are kids who could be six and kindergarten ain't ready for them. You know, I mean, how long do we keep them out until we start it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you have 20-year-old people on your junior varsity high school softball team. Or, I mean, it's ridiculous. So I don't know. In your case, September 2nd sounds like a reasonable time for the kid to go.
Yeah.
He's five when school starts. Now, I started in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The cutoff date was March 1st. My birthday's February 9th. I was four until February 9th when I turned five and started kindergarten. So I was always the youngest, always.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. I think we pay a lot of attention to that. And you know what? Kids at five are ready to learn. And some are going to learn faster and quicker than others. And it doesn't matter really whether you hold them back. If they're ready to go, and I know they have those little developmental things, are they ready to go? You know, your preschool teacher can tell you whether the kid is ready to go or not.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, no, well, that's what I was, I guess, really getting at is that if I
have to give you a good reason why he's not ready other than he's young. All right, they'd have to tell me more than that, because if he's ready, he knows his letters, he can write his name, he knows his colors, he can count to 20. You know, what the fuck else do you need to go to kindergarten? All right? Of course, we don't even ask them to tie their shoes now.
Oh, really?
When I went to kindergarten, you couldn't go to kindergarten until you could tie your goddamn shoes. Now with Velcro, I mean, say what you want about my generation, but I could tie my fucking shoes in kindergarten.
Yeah. I didn't know that there was no longer, I got to look into that as a prerequisite, because I thought it was interesting when I got older and then I had kids and I found out there were certain things that you had to be able to, I think, my dad sent me to kindergarten, I had to know my phone number, I had to know how to tie my shoes, and I think I needed to know how to spell my name or see it or something like that. Like, not necessarily read it, but just recognize it or something. There were three things, and that name thing I might be wrong on. But I know the other two, know my phone number and know how to tie my own shoes. And then I thought it was interesting that it wasn't really part of the prerequisite, but they kind of had to make it at my elementary school that it was unofficial, that you had to be potty trained. Like, they couldn't have you show up at five and in diapers, which I was just shocked about myself. But that's me coming from a guy, again, who's had kids that were potty trained younger. I'm sure that there's a parent out there who's like, nope, fuck you. I tried everything, and my kid would not. Isn't that hard? Is that hard for you to deal with? I feel like parenting seems to have this limbo or gray area where everybody has their own opinion of what is black or white, but that culmination of everything makes everything gray, where there is no end-all, be-all. Everybody just has their own philosophy of, well, this should be the end-all, be-all.
I tell new parents, everybody who's ever had a child thinks they're a fucking expert. So you got to sit there, you got to learn to listen, shake your head in agreement, and then think about it, mull over it. And a lot of times you're going to say, I mean, maybe 99% of the time, I said, that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
And then you move on to the next thing, because I don't know. You know what it is we're all struggling, and it's not as hard as we make it to be.
Yes.
Honestly, sometimes you just have to let kids be kids. And I think that, you know, sending them into nursery school at three and four and, you know, having structured stuff. I mean, how can a boy sit for 6.5 hours in a first grade class without getting ants in their pants?
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't do it. You know, and recess is only, you ask a first grader what their favorite part of the school day is, they're going to tell you recess.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. What you just saying that made me realize that, fuck a little boy, try a grown ass man. Isn't the statistic that a man doesn't go 19 seconds without thinking about sex in some way, shape, or form?
That's right. I always thought a good episode of Survivor on TV would be Amish Survivor.
Uh-huh.
Sit in a fucking church for 8 hours, build a barn the next day, see if you survive that, you know?
I love it. Well, and then to get back to the question, you were saying that if you start at six, is there any way that parents can look to what would be some signs to try to wean their kid? Is it a weaning process to get off of the Adderall, or is it just a cold turkey? I mean,
well,
does he have to get some Oxycontin? What happens here?
No, well, it only stays in their system. You know, if we use the sustained release stuff, it's only in their system for the 8 hours during the school day. So it's no cumulative effect of it. And the kids that, you know, because fortunately, you know, kids grow. They gain weight every year. And if you're staying at the same dose and not having to increase the dose because symptoms are coming back, you know, as they gain 10, 20, 30 pounds, those are the kids that sometimes you're able to stop it because they're not requiring as much per pound, you know, as they get bigger. You know, the kids who every time they grow 10 pounds, you're adjusting the dose up a little bit to make up for it. Those are the kids that tend to, you know, be on it for longer periods of time.
They're on some kind of a loyalty program.
Right, right. You know, you want to take out stock in Concerta and things like that. But
all right, well, let's transition from that to a little bit of a lighter question. That's when will my child stop screaming like a psycho for a haircut, and what can I do to make it better? Again, this is what I love about my new relationship with you. Yeah. This is not a question I would ever imagine throwing to a pediatrician. But I'm not going to get here because you had an answer for the first one about dogs. So I'm going to step down and go, okay, do you have anything for this haircut situation?
The only thing to do is to keep getting the kids haircut and having a haircut person that can deal with a screaming child. Yeah. And eventually it's going to get better. You know, you just, like I said, it's aversive therapy. You throw them in the water, they sink or swim. But you're going to be there to get them in case they start to take on water. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But the haircut, things, sometimes things just have to be done, you know? And you just deal with the screaming. I mean, believe me, I am screamed at a lot of my day. I got pissed on by a 10-day-old just 2 days ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so, yeah, you know, it happens. And, you know, I don't, as long as they have somebody that is, you know, good with kids and willing to listen to the screaming. I mean, I don't know that I'd ever want to work at one of those Supercut type places, but I'm sure they deal with that on a regular basis. So,
well, I had an experience at Supercut. I have a lady that cuts my hair and we pay more money and we've become friendly with her and all that jazz. And we took my kid, my oldest son, there, and it was, it's just, it's a salon type place, so it's not really suitable for kids. And I've noticed a few looks from the owner that's like, what the fuck are you doing here? I'm trying to run a classy joint. And, you know, it's one of those first experiences where it's like, you lesser people with children, you know, or whatever. So we stopped taking him there, and Supercuts is fine for him. And my 20-month-old just got his first haircut. And she kept, like, telling me to talk to him. And I thought she was, like, she had too much nervous energy about it. And she was like, if you keep talking to him, he'll be fine. If you, and I just kept talking to him. But he was just kind of sitting there chilling. He wasn't really freaking out or anything. So I agree with what you're saying, I guess, is the short end of that. Is that
you just got to do what you got to do.
Keep rotating through people. And sooner or later, you'll find a person who's, like, who's very chill and has almost a zen approach to doing it. And then you just got to ride that out until the kid gets comfortable and is fine with it.
I've had parents say to me, oh, she's screaming because she doesn't like beards. I said, oh, well, I'll just go shave it off for her. You know, I mean, everybody, you just got to deal with beards and Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and Mickey Mouse and people who cut your hair. They're always going to be there. And if you don't let them deal with it now, then they're going to be mental cases later.
All right. Our next question, I think, has a tone of somebody who gets the humor. And that's what I'm hoping for, because he starts it off. OK, so I tried to look this up on Google/WebMD and couldn't find anything. Then we asked our doctor and she didn't think it was anything to worry about. But our kids is special. OK, now that I've gotten you all pissed off here, here's my real question. My son, who will be 4 in May, gets very stiff legs after sitting down for very long, to the point where he can't really walk. When he does walk, he looks like Frankenstein, doesn't really bend his knees. There have been times when taking him out of the booster or car seat and putting him down, he will just fall over when he tries to take his first step. I don't think his legs are falling asleep, since he never complains about them tingling. Other than that, other than right after getting up, he is a normal running, jumping, bouncing off the walls boy. My wife worries because she has rheumatoid arthritis. Do you have any insight into this? Is this something we should push more with our doctor?
All right. That's another good question. And again, there's follow-up questions I could ask that might give me more information, but assuming, because they didn't say it, that the kid doesn't have any, you know, swelling or redness of his joints and stuff like that. I mean, to have rheumatoid arthritis, you have to have arthritis, and you would see redness, swelling, warmth of the joints if that was a problem. It sounds like he's having, you know, Charlie horses or leg cramps. You know, sometimes you sleep or sit in a certain position and the back of the knee goes into spasm and you can't, you know, I'm sure you've had it happen to you while you've been sleeping and you can't straighten your leg out and it tightens up in the back there. And all, you know, you can do for that is kind of rub it and try to walk it off. And 4-year-olds especially, you know, we try to limit how much they drink before they go to bed at night because we don't want them to wet their bed. Mm-hmm. And things like being a little underhydrated can lead to more muscle spasms in Charlie horses. Kids who come in with, you know, knee spasms, Charlie horses at my office, I always tell them to drink a little more before they go to bed and eat a banana because potassium helps. So eat a banana. I've never had a kid that I've told to eat a banana before bed with cramps come back and tell me they're still having cramps. So it sounds like that's what it is. So more fluids, bananas. And if there's no redness, swelling, warmth over any of the joints, and the fact that once he kind of, you know, stretches it out, he's able to jump and bounce off the wall, you know, that doesn't sound like arthritis to me. It sounds like muscle spasm and, you know, heating pad, Advil, fluids, banana. That's what I do.
I love it. Now, I have a thing I would like to throw out there just for out of curiosity. Here's my theory, again, as a layperson. Does it annoy you that I do this with my layperson opinion?
No, I appreciate it.
Okay, good. Is that what do you think the likelihood, because I found this, other people pointed it out with me and my kid, is that if mom has rheumatoid arthritis and she's sitting down for a little bit and she has a little bit of like, when she gets up, that he kind of picks that up as a behavior and that he, you know what I mean? Like just the way they pick up our speech patterns or our own little patterns of what we like to do. Do you think that there's a chance that that might be it too?
They can definitely mimic behaviors, that's for sure. I mean, I don't know that a 3-year-old could possibly know what a headache is unless he's seen an adult complain about a headache.
My head hurts, yeah.
Yes, I think we you know, to this day in my life, I'm 49, I don't think I've ever had a headache. I don't think I have. I have absolutely no comprehension as to what that fucking means because I have never had an ache in my head and had to reach for a medication to make it go away. It's never happened.
You
to
never
me.
Put that roll-on deodorant across head on or apply directly to the forehead. You
know? Never, never. I've never had a headache. And so maybe I've had earaches. I can be sympathetic to earaches, but headaches, I don't know. But I have 3-year-olds coming in saying they have a pounding headache. And how can a 3-year-old know what a pounding fucking headache is? Oh, it's right here at the temples, Dr. Suke.
I feel it behind my eyes, Doc. It's my I think it's a migraine.
I guess they do have learned behaviors.
I Googled it on my iPad Touch, and I think I have a migraine.
Oh, God, I'm telling you.
Oh, damn it, Dr. J, I love you. Oh, that's great. This one is another one I thought was really interesting. This came via Facebook. It says, if your kid needs stitches in the ER, is it okay to ask for a plastic surgeon to keep the scarring to a minimum? The answer will be too late for me, but could help other parents.
Well, that is a good question again. And I would say it depends on where the laceration is. I mean, honestly, if you have a laceration on your arm or your leg or something, you know, does it matter if a plastic surgeon sutures it up? If it's going to cost you an extra 3 or 4 hours in the emergency room to put a couple of stitches in your leg and your kid's, you know, not really looking at a career as a leg model, then you probably don't need a plastic surgeon. But I would say if it's on the face, probably a good idea to request a plastic surgeon. And certainly we see a lot of cuts and stuff through the lip, and you got to make sure that the border of the lip gets lined up perfectly. So if you ever have you know, someone that's not a good surgeon suture up around the lip, sometimes that vermilion border doesn't meet up and it's always going to look a little funny. So on the face and around the lips, almost always would want to have a plastic surgeon take care of that. So personal story, when my daughter fell in the bathtub and split her chin open, not on my watch. I was at the grocery store. All right. Let's point that out. I came back home to a bloodied child.
Okay? I almost spit coffee all over my computer. Not on my watch.
So she split open her chin, and, you know, I brought her to the emergency room and I called my friend, the plastic surgeon, and said, get your ass in here and suture my daughter's chin up. And he came in and did it. So I had a little pull on that one, though.
That's interesting. I would have told that this is another thing that I would never have even thought of. And I thought that that does sound a little presumptuous to have somebody go, listen, you know, my kid, obviously he's easy on the eyes, so I'm going to need a plastic surgeon to handle that moneymaker. But is that a common thing, or is that just a thing because you're a doctor you knew? Or
oh, no, I just, it was on her face. That was the only reason.
But I mean,
and honestly, there's nothing a plastic surgeon can't fix later. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So, if you get a scar and some butcher takes care of your kid's chin in the ER and, you know, it looks horrible, it can always get fixed later, too. So, you know, but again, those are the things that make us individuals, our little scars and nicks and dents in our head. That's what makes us human.
Again, thank you so much, Dr. J.
I see kids with bruised up knees and stuff, and I tell them, good, I'm glad to see you're using your body.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know? You're living life. this other question is kind of a two-parter. Something about this damn RS virus, or I think people call it, this is another one of those ATM machine, right? It's the RSV virus is what it's called, but she's right because the V is for virus. Right. And middle ear infection. So I guess let's do the RS. My son had a scare with this back in December where they had to test him for RSV. But what is that? Is that respiratory?
Respiratory syncytial virus.
Nice. That sounds sexy.
It comes every November, like November to April, and it's a virus that causes really bad colds in older kids, but in kids under two and young babies, especially babies who don't have healthy lungs to begin with, preemie babies, things like that, it can really go to their lungs. Like you can have a runny nose one day and they're not breathing 2 days later. So it's a serious virus especially in the wintertime up here in the Northeast, and it causes wheezing and viral pneumonia. And it's one of a few viruses that can actually cause middle ear infections too. There's a vaccine for RSV, but it costs about $1,500 a month to get it. And you have to get it monthly, November through April. So it's really just reserved to give to babies that were former preemies, babies that were on ventilators, babies with heart disease, babies who have cystic fibrosis. So they can get a vaccine for it, but it's something we have to apply to their insurance company for coverage and prove why they need it.
Yeah. Because in there, am I saying this right? In that, in their situation, it ups the issue of fatality, right? It could be a fatal issue for them. So because I'm afraid that other parents out there, you know, cause it's a thing that parents do. It's like, I hear you say that my kid could die. So I want to go out and make sure that there's absolutely everything I could do to make sure my kid doesn't get this. But even with my kid, who's prone to, like, say, a bronchitis or a light pneumonia, if he gets a cold and doesn't get that inhaler steroid in him, that doesn't mean he's going to die.
Right.
It just means that, if you do have, like, all those conditions that you just described, then more than likely your pediatrician is already going to be all over it.
Exactly.
They need to have this.
I mean, we keep a list of all the kids that need to get it in November so that we get on it right away. And, you know, the other kids that get it, I mean, they're going to get it, they're going to wheeze and they're going to have problems with breathing and the worst cold of their life. But, you know, that's why we have office hours and hospitals and other things in case things aren't the typical cold. So, and it's a nasty one. I mean, fortunately, I say that the vaccine fucking works. I haven't had a kid who's gotten the vaccine catch RSV in about 10 years. So it works well, but it's those, you know, those 9-month-old kids who catch RSV that, you know, end up needing to be on a little oxygen for a couple of days and do fine afterwards. But that's why, you know, that's why we go to work every day to see sick kids.
Yeah. And so is there a way that you can tell if your kid has RSV as opposed to just a common cold?
It's just worse than a cold. You can do a culture. They have to stick a swab up your nose and they can do an RSV culture to see if that's what it is. And a lot of times I think, well, if you went to the ER or something, they would have done
they did a swab.
Done that. So.
And, so,
and again, you don't treat it any differently than you treat a cold because it's a virus and you can't do anything except kind of let it run its course. But for the little ones, you know, they might need a little extra oxygen. They might need a little, breathing treatments in terms of opening up their airway like an asthmatic, and they might need some IV fluids to get them over the hump.
So there isn't, if my kid has like a common cold or is coughing a lot, there's nothing I can do to identify that. So I guess the next step would be just like the duration, like if it's more than 2 or 3 days or something, or?
Well, most viruses are going to last 3 to 5 days. RSV is kind of mild the first day, and that second and third day, they just have so much thick snot and stuff, it's hard for them to breathe through their nose, and they'll start breathing faster, maybe using extra muscles in their chest. I mean, it's obvious that it's a little
more than usual.
More than a cold.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And then middle ear infection. I don't know what her specific question was, but
I don't know if it was related to RSV, but RSV does cause middle ear infections. Most of the time, middle ear infections are caused by bacteria that live in the nose and the throat and just take advantage of the fact that you're stuffed up. So they go into the middle ear and cause pus to form there. But you know, when you need to treat middle ear infections, you know, you're looking for red bulging eardrum. I like to call it buttery looking fluid on the inside of the ear, kind of a yellow, thick, pussy looking stuff. And if you see that, they need antibiotics. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
What's the difference between a middle ear infection and a regular ear infection?
Well, you got middle ear infection is the fluid on the inside, on the other side of the eardrum, causing the eardrum to bulge out towards the ear canal. Uh-huh. And then, like, swimmer's ear is an outer ear infection. Which is an infection of the skin that lines the ear canal. But for kids, it just hurts. Mm-hmm. So in the summertime, you kind of have to look because you don't know. Is it swimmer's ear, which you're going to put drops in? Or is it a middle ear infection, which drops aren't going to do anything for? So,
oh, because it's deep in there.
But the kids feel the same pain. Mm-hmm. They can't tell the difference.
So it has to be something that a doctor would go in and would see, like what you're talking about, that buttery discharge. And
right.
There's, and because I can't look in. I've always been curious about that, too, is that, and I'm sure that there's an obviously a valid reason, but I would think it would be nice to be able to live in a society where I could have like that little tool that you guys use to look down in my kid's ear to better equip myself to describe to you what it is that I'm seeing, but I guess that would make more problems. It's just like what happens with WebMD. The more that parents know, for the majority of us, it seems that that creates more problems for the pediatrician.
Right.
Yeah. So
that's years of training to know what the hell you're looking at in the ear. I can't tell you how many times I see a kid in the afternoon and the school nurse looks in the ear at school and says the eardrum's red. Kid comes in. Eardrums are fine, and they have like a new molar erupting somewhere. And, so you know, let me tell you, parents who are called at 2 o'clock to leave work early to bring their kid to the doctor because they have an ear infection that turns out to be a tooth at the age of 5 or 6, they're not real happy campers.
They're not too pleased about the eight hours in the ER.
Yeah, you know, the kids get another set of molars between 5 and 7 and 11 and 13. So I can't tell you how many times kids come in with earaches that turn out to be you want to tell parent that their 13-year-old is teething. That goes over well.
That's awesome. Well, we have one more question, and then I have a couple to kind of wrap up here. We're almost done. But this last person asked, any opinions on infant ear piercing?
All right. Yeah. Well, when I was a resident, I actually took care of a little girl who swallowed an earring post and lost 18 inches of her intestines. And that kind of left a mark on me about, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't know that knowing that babies from 6 to 18 months put every goddamn thing they touch into their mouth, it makes me a little uneasy about piercing babies' ears just for the safety point there.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I have two daughters. My older daughter, she's 22. She's never gotten her ears pierced, and my younger one has. But it's, you know, a personal choice that maybe a kid should be able to make for themselves someday. So my rule at my office is I will pierce ears after the age of 5. I won't do it before 5, and I don't do boys. My office
is that a common thing now? Is that because here's ear piercing for boys, I felt like was popular when I was, you know, probably the late 80s, early 90s when I was in late elementary school. And then now I feel like it's like common practice, or like I just feel like it's a normal thing. Am I crazy or I know I'm saying I think it went away.
Be a party to it.
Yeah. I like that. So that's you kind of taking
with these gauges. I actually had a teenage boy patient of mine come in, and instead of a gauge, he actually had the medication cap from a CVS pharmacy through his earlobe.
Oh my gosh.
What the fuck is that, man?
Yeah. Nothing makes me feel like a get off my lawn old man than watching those people with those holes in their ears. And just all I think about is that, do you really think when you're 55, you're going to look at that and go, yeah, this was a good call? Like, yeah. Like, that's the only reason I wish I could be immortal is to see what grandpas are going to look like 80 years from now or more.
It's going to be funny. I'll tell you that much.
Oh, man. Well, I had some questions of some stuff that came up while we have about 10 minutes left or so. Do you have time? Is that cool?
Sure.
So I had a question that came up but it's unrelated to my kids per se. My wife has had this, like, cough, like, and she was, you know, coughing. And I kept trying to get her just to take the over-the-counter cough medicine. And, you know, that's a fight where I'm like, I fucking take care of everyone in this house and everything to do with this house. Can't you be the other adult and just take care of your goddamn self? And just when it's not getting better, just do what I tell you to do. Your way doesn't fucking work. But to not make you a marriage counselor, here's my point. She went into to our doctor, and the doctor prescribed her an antibiotic. Now, it was my understanding that you couldn't actually take an antibiotic for a cold or anything like that.
Right.
And so I was wondering, just so, because I think this also happens within kids, because I've had my kids have a little cough, and then somebody says, "Oh, you need that's a cough that you need an antibiotic for." I'm like, "You're the fucking lady at the Southwest terminal. You don't fucking know what my kid needs." And what
I had a cough once.
Yeah,
I'm an expert.
Yeah, exactly. I just had a cough, and they gave me an antibiotic. So I was wondering if you wouldn't mind explaining what is something that needs an antibiotic and what is something that cannot, an antibiotic does not help. And
All right. And
if you also don't mind, what is an antibiotic?
Gotcha. All right. Coughs and colds, viral things, usually 3 to 5 days of symptoms, maybe another couple, 3-4 days of lingering cough, and then you're better.
Okay.
That's a typical viral cough cold. When you need an antibiotic is when the virus causes something to settle. And the only way you're ever going to know that is by listening to the lungs. And when you listen to the lungs, if there's, you know, that we call them crackles, if there's wet sounds in the lungs, that means there's fluid down there, infectious fluid, pus, whatever. So you can tell by listening. If you have a cough that is productive from your lungs, where you're coughing up stuff from your lungs, not just the post-nasal drip that you're usually coughing up. You know, if it's green, if it's yellow, and it's coming from your lungs, then yeah, that's probably something that needs an antibiotic. And then viruses also can settle in the sinuses and settle into the ears, so that, you know, the cold kind of sets up this whole thing where things just stop moving along efficiently and the fluids get thicker and they build up in your ears and your sinuses and your chest. And, you know, if you're able to mobilize them, you know, then it's a 3 to 5 day illness. And if you're not in tip top shape, things can settle in your lungs, your sinuses, and your ears. So, you know, I know for me, my cold turns to a sinus infection when my upper teeth start to hurt. When I got enough schnot in my maxillary sinuses where it's pressing down on my teeth and my upper teeth start to ache, that's when I know it's time for an antibiotic.
Really?
But when I just have, you know, green schnot in my nose and, you know, no headache or anything else, well, then it's just a cold. So, you know, and what is an antibiotic? It's basically a medication that kills bacteria. Some kill and some just slow their growth, but most of them are bactericidal, so they kill the bacteria, but the bacteria get smart to the antibiotics, so you use the same antibiotic all the time. Bacteria that were left behind get smarter, and then they don't respond to that antibiotic anymore.
That's what I've
heard. So you don't want to overuse them, and that's why you don't treat coughs and colds with antibiotics. You treat bronchitis with an antibiotic. You treat a sinus infection with an antibiotic. You treat strep throat and ear infections with an antibiotic, but it's not going to do anything for a cold if it's virus, and viruses don't respond to antibiotics.
Because I heard Dr. Drew talk about that a long time ago on an episode of Loveline, where he said that it's becoming this nature where people are coming in expecting antibiotics, and he said, and he's seen these physicians that are just throwing antibiotics out there, and what they're not understanding is that if you put the antibiotics out there, that the bacteria will evolve, and thus you're making the antibiotics obsolete, and then they have to come up with a new antibiotic, and you're strengthening. That's why it sounds like what you're saying, you have to wait for something really severe so that you can almost kind of hold on to this nuclear bomb that you have that could go after the bacteria and kill it.
I have parents who bring their kids in on Monday with a cold, and it's a cold. Mm-hmm. And they come back on Friday and it's an ear infection. And I get kind of this, I told you so look. And I'm like, do you know the other nine kids I saw on Monday with colds didn't come back with a fucking ear infection. Okay, sweetheart. It happens.
Oh my God. It must be so hard not to have a fuck off chambered at all times just to throw at any parent that comes into your office. I could not do your job.
I went into the hospital to see a 7-year-old girl with pneumonia. And I go in and I say, hi, sweetie. I came in to see you. I heard you were really sick. And the mother said, and she's not saying anything. The mother says, well, aren't you going to say hello to Dr. Sute? And this 7-year-old girl said, fuck off.
Really?
Honest to God. Pleasant children, I'll tell you. A lot of them are really, really sweethearts.
That's great. Fuck off. I'm sick, bitch. Yeah. Oh, I love
it. It's not, and you know, it's not only the time spent in medical school and the money spent for medical school. It was fucking hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to just get that out there. It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
But fuck off, Dr. Sute.
Oh, I thought she was saying it to mom.
She said it to me.
That's oh my God, what a little bitch. I thought aren't you going to say hi to the doctor? I thought she just looked at her mom and said, fuck off, mom.
She looked at me.
Wow.
And said, fuck off. I'm glad I clarified that.
Yeah.
Because, that was all on me.
Wow. Yeah, that's a little bitch. I don't care how old she is.
And I just saw a 2-month-old baby yesterday, and the parents said that they I had apparently given them my business card at a comedy show, and they picked me as the kid's doctor, which I thought was funny.
I love that. I talked about it on the last episode we did or whatever, was that I would imagine after hearing your act that people would say that, you know, I don't know if I could have him as my pediatrician. I was like, I think exactly the opposite, because you know exactly what he's thinking. You know exactly what he's feeling. So I think your patients who see you at a comedy show and go, can I get your card, are got to be the best patients ever, I would imagine.
They know exactly where I'm coming from.
Yeah,
so exactly. I just find it amazing. I thought the comedy would scare away some of the deadwood, but... Because there are some ill-humored fuckers out there, let me tell you.
Oh, my gosh. I could only imagine. We're really lucky with our pediatrician that she gets it, and she understands it. Like, she could shoot straight with me and tell me if I'm being overly cautious and all that bullshit. But anyway, the last two questions I had are actually kind of teeth-related. I'll end with this other one because I think it'll be a nice one for you to maybe get more frustrated about. But,
okay, good.
Is that first was my son started telling me last night that one of his teeth are kind of wiggling, and he's only 4.
Yeah.
And I just was curious, is that when he starts losing his teeth? But I heard you say that molars, they have a second set of molars that come in around 5 or 6.
Is this the one whose birthday's in September?
Yep.
So he's only 4.5. I mean, I call them 5 to 7-year-old molars, but I've seen 4-year-olds get sometimes. And the front teeth start wiggling like 4 to 5, and those two things kind of start at the same time. So kids who are, you know, feeling their front teeth wiggling, you know, generally within a couple of months are going to start feeling the molars coming in the back, and vice versa. If they feel the molars coming in the back, it's going to be a couple months and their front teeth will start wiggling. So, you know, I've had kids lose their front teeth and have the, you know, grown-up teeth come in at 4, so that's not unusual. You didn't smack him in the face, did you?
Not more than once. I mean, undeservedly, I think. So I don't think it's really me.
No, if he were 3, that'd be odd. But 4.5, you know, he also got
all of his teeth before he was 10 months. And so when we took him to see a dentist, they said, well, he's all okay. She goes, well, he got his teeth early. That just means he's going to lose his teeth early as well. So she said, be prepared for them to come out a little early. And I'd forgotten that until you brought that up. I thought it was more like 7 or 8 is when I had to start thinking about that stuff. But
there's some kids that hold on to them till 2nd grade. But
that was me.
Most of the time, kindergarten, 1st grade, they're going to lose their first tooth.
I still had, I think, like 3 baby teeth by the time I was almost 15, 16 years old, something like that. And then my other question, this is the one that I think will frustrate you and my poor buddies that are new to parenting. And the genesis of your and my relationship, they have a 7-month-old, and I'm already laughing. Or no, he's 5 months. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the person who wrote in. He's 5 months old, and they, she said, I go, how you doing? She's like, oh, he was sleeping really good. And then out of nowhere, it's only 3 hours. That's all I could get in the middle of the night. And I said, well, what do his gums look like? And she's like, what? I go, he might be cutting teeth. Do you have some teeth or stuff that you could put in his mouth to numb his gums? And she was like, what? No, what? And I said, he's probably cutting teeth. And then she was like, really? And I go, yeah. I go, get some. If you don't have the Tylenol, I said, make sure you have some on hand. And I said, and I'll give you some little teethers or whatever. And it might be a thing that you would disagree with, but I would be curious to see what you thought of it. Our doctor said that the Orajel, she said in some kids, has they've seen that it can cause like heart problems or something like that, the Orajel brand. So she recommended the little teethers is what she did. So I gave them a tube of it. And so my friend, like 2 days later, this is what, the closest I will ever come to feeling what it is to be Dr. J is she sends us an email. She goes, yeah, last night he just would not go to sleep. So I gave him some Tylenol. And then a half hour later, he went to sleep and slept for 4 hours.
You're like Annie Sullivan, the miracle worker.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And I was like sitting there going, and then she, but the tone of what she was saying was like, so I don't know if it's teeth. I'm like, yes, it's fucking teeth. Are you shitting me? That's how long Tylenol lasts. She's like, I thought Tylenol lasted 6 to 8 hours. I'm like, no, read the bottle. It says 4 to 6. Are you fucking kidding me right now?
Yep. Well, you're learning. Yeah. You're learning, Justin. Thank you for passing those things. Listen, a kid kid starts teething at 2.5 months. Look at a 2.5 month baby. They're drooling. They're bubbling. Yeah. You got going through 5 bibs a day. You're not going to get a tooth till probably 6 months, but teething and the pain of teething starts at 2.5 months. Well, and if you had a toothache, you would take some fucking Tylenol, okay? You wouldn't spread some Orajel on your tooth. You'd take Tylenol. In fact, if you could take OxyContin for a toothache, you would. I'm amazed these little babies with 8 teeth breaking through at the same time are getting by on 80 milligrams of Tylenol. So give them something, for Christ's sake. It hurts.
It's so funny to me, and it's unfair to them, but I think it's so, because she goes, you know, he is chewing on his fingers all the time. I'm like, yeah, then that means he's pushing, he's chewing on something.
And you mentioned Orajel, too. It's also, if kids who are doing, like, solid food and stuff swallow the Orajel, it can actually numb the gag reflex in the back of their throat, so it can actually be dangerous in terms of aspirating food or formula or stuff. So I tell them just to use the Tylenol and the topical stuff like Orajel probably aren't all that that helpful, because you got to know what tooth is bothering them too.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you spread it over the whole mouth, and then it's a lot of extra
well, then
stuff.
That's a point that she made, is that she said to me, she goes, well, I don't want to give him this stuff because he could choke, and I go, or gag, like she was afraid that it would numb his mouth and that he would choke on his food or whatever. And he's breastfeeding, he's not on solid food yet. And I said, I go, well, and from my standpoint, I looked at it like I have 2 kids that have come out of this with teething. And that's what I did was I used the teethers. If it was in the middle of the night, I would use the teethers to get him to calm down because it was instant. And then I would wait a little bit after he calmed down and then give him some Tylenol so that it could last longer. And then that would feel better. But I would use the little teethers just as like an instant relief. Is that a bad call?
That sounds perfect.
Yeah. So, and I told her, like, and this is where, if you tell me if I'm crazy, but she said, well, I just don't want him to choke. And I said, I guarantee you he will not choke if you just because you use teethers, because this is a product that they wouldn't put out there. But it sounds like to me what you're saying is that where you could run the risk is that if that's your only method, like if you're just constantly applying Orajel and teethers,
you're going to be numbing that. Yeah, but if you're using it here and there, it's not a big problem. But like I said, you're only going to get a very short period of relief from that anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
I told
all
her,
the saliva washes it away and it doesn't – Tylenol will give you 4 to 6 hours, you know. And like I said, as an adult who's had toothaches, you know, you take something for the pain, right?
Yeah.
It's only fair.
Well, and I told her, I said, put a little bit on your own gum. I said, that's what I did, so I could just know what they're feeling and how long it would last is what I did. And she goes, oh, then I could know if he's not going to choke. Like, she said it twice. And I said, I guarantee you he is not going to choke. So,
I mean, imagine the poor baby at 5 months of age, you know, having a toothache, crying out, I had a toothache, it hurts, and then mommy's coming, shoving a titty in its mouth. No, this isn't what I need.
Yeah.
That's making it hurt more.
Yeah,
no, don't want that. Don't want
suction.
That. Give me some fucking Tylenol. Get the titty out of my face and give me some Tylenol. I feel bad.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. J. We will talk to him again next month. So if you have any more questions, either about what we already talked about here or new stuff that has come up, please send your emails to questions@thedadpodcast.com. And again, I cannot thank you enough for your time, sir. I really do appreciate
it. My pleasure. Justin, this is the best part of my month. Thank you.
Oh, man, you're too kind. I said it before, and at some point I will stop saying it, but you have officially made a dream come true in that I get to live out a little love line fantasy and talk to a real doctor about real stuff. And I'm excited because I think this really will help a lot of people.
And the questions, everybody who sent in questions, thank you. They were all terrific questions. And there are no stupid questions, so just send them in.
Because that's what I think, that's from your standpoint, that's kind of the thing that you're kind of doing, a pay it forward to the rest of the pediatricians in the world, is to say, if you ask the stupid questions here, then it helps everybody else. You're a saint for what you're doing here.
Both of us are. We'll see what the new Pope has to say about that.
All right. Well, thank you again very much, Dr. J, and we will see you in a month, sir.
Can't wait. Thank you.
Again, thank you to Dr. J for helping us out. I got some plugs for you guys. I'm going to be in Fresno, California, March 29th and 30th. And then the first weekend in April, April 3rd through April 7th, I will be headlining the River Center Comedy Club in San Antonio, Texas. And April 12th and 13th, I will be headlining at Flappers in Claremont. That's in the Inland Empire in Claremont, California. And any of my other dates are available on justincomedy.com, my website. If you'd like to follow the show on Twitter, join us at @dadpodcast, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, facebook.com/dadpodcast. Also, I really want to thank a lot of you guys have been stepping in and doing the $2 a month paid subscription. And really, again, I know I keep saying it and I'm beating a dead horse, and I'm not trying to talk you into doing something you don't want to do. I'm just trying to, because I think people listen and then they're in their cars or whatever and they forget. So I'm just trying to remind everybody, because it literally could help change my life if I could do this for a living. If everybody listening just did the $2 a month thing, that would be a humongous help for me. So just go to thedadpodcast.com, and on the left-hand side, there's a thing that you can sign up through PayPal, and just $2 a month. That's all it takes, 50 cents an episode. So thanks again. On behalf of my good friend, Dr. J, this is Justin Worsham saying, stay frosty.